Welcome to EM Pulse, bringing research and expert opinion to the bedside.
We're your hosts, Julia Magana
and Sarah Medeiros.
Welcome back to EM Pulse. You know, one of the best parts of being a podcast host is getting to explore new research and see how it applies to my own everyday practice. But so many times the message is, this is interesting, more to come. But guess what? That is not the message today. Today we're talking about that tip of the pyramid research when a clinical decision rule was derived, internally validated, studied in many other settings, and now externally validated as well. We're talking about the PCARN TBI injury prediction rule and another PCARN injury prediction rule regarding intra-abdominal injury. Doctors Nate Cooperman and Jim Holmes are the authors of PCARN Prediction Rules for CT Imaging of Children Presenting to the Emergency Department with Blunt Abdominal or Minor Head Trauma, a multicenter prospective validation study published in The Lancet. And they are here today with me, guys. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So, Nate and Jim, it's interesting to kind of hear the journey of an idea. Nate, I know you started on the journey to derive a tool clinicians can use to decide when to get a head CT in, what, 1996?
Yeah, I started this journey in 1996, or actually 1995. I was helping some other people with their rule, and I thought, I think I could do this better.
And then ultimately, the prediction rule was published in 2009, and many other papers have been published since then about that. And Jim, you joined the journey to derive and validate a clinical decision rule to help clinicians know when to get a CT with abdominal injury in what year?
Started the first study in 1996 when I was a resident.
Wow, that's huge. And you published in 2013 as well.
Our multi-center study was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2013. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you originally derived and internally validated the head injury prediction rule with inside of PCARN or Pediatric Emergency Care Applied Research Networks hospitals. But the journey didn't end there. And multiple other sites validated the TBI or head injury prediction rule. And now you guys have your own large external validation. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So let's start with a quick review of what the injury prediction rules are. Nate, can you briefly remind us about the head injury prediction rule?
Sure. And first, I'll describe that Jim and I have been partners on this journey for the whole time. That as I sort of led the head injury one, and Jim was the kind of chief co-investigator, and then we swapped roles. Jim led the abdominal injury one, and I played the vice versa role. But what we did, you know, starting in around, it was published in 2009, so we started around 2006, we enrolled 40,000 children to create a prediction rule, really just to identify those children who had such a low risk of traumatic brain injury or TBI that they would not need CT scans. So the way we had powered it, that is, when you decide how many patients you needed, we wanted to power it so that it would be, you know, very accurate but also very precise, meaning that the confidence intervals around the rule would be very tight and very narrow. So we figured we needed something, you know, more than 20,000 children. But what happened is we started the study and we were enrolling, and actually we were enrolling at a faster pace than we anticipated. So we ended up enrolling 40,000 children. And with that, we were able to create a rule for children younger than two, separate from a rule for children two and older. And we were also able to enroll enough patients to then validate it. Although this is a small nuance for your listeners, but we just statistically validated it. That is, when we were enrolling, we just kept on enrolling. We didn't know what the rule was. We just enrolled enough to create the rule and then to derive it on this new population without yet knowing what the rule was.
That's super interesting. So remind us, what did you guys find?
Yeah, so what we found is this. So we created a rule for children younger than 2 years. And if you don't have any of these six factors, you are at extremely low risk of having a clinically important traumatic brain injury. By the way, we define traumatic brain injury that is a clinically important traumatic brain injury as one that required neurosurgery, one that required intubation for more than 24 hours for management, one that resulted in death, or one that resulted in more than or two or more nights in the hospital associated with a positive CT scan. So for children younger than two, there was three factors that were similar to the older group, and that was having a GCS score of less than 15. Remember, we only enrolled patients with GCS scores of 14 or 15 because we knew prior to this is that a GCS score of 13, you already have about a 20% risk of having a positive CT. You don't need the rule. So amongst those that were enrolled, if you have a GCS less than 15 or signs of, you know, altered mental status, if you had a non-frontal scalp hematoma, a brief history of loss of consciousness that is more than 5 seconds, this is again for the younger group, signs of a palpable skull fracture, or if there was such a big hematoma you really couldn't tell whether there's a fracture in there, if the patient was acting abnormally per the parent, or there was a severe mechanism of injury, and your readers can read what those are. So if you didn't have any of those risk factors, you're at an extremely low risk, less than 1 in 5,000 of having an important traumatic brain injury. And likewise, for the older group, we also identified 6 variables. And to be clear, it wasn't Jim and I picking the variables. It was the software identifying the ones that were important. And 3 of them were the same. The GCS or Glasgow Coma Scale score less than 15 or any other signs of altered mental status, any history of loss of consciousness rather than more than 5 seconds, vomiting since the time of injury, clinical signs of a basilar skull fracture, a severe headache, or a severe mechanism of injury. And again, if you didn't have any of those risk factors, then you're at very low risk of traumatic brain injury and you would not need a CT. Importantly, I just want to say, and then I'll turn it back to you, this was never meant to say who needed a CT scan. It was really meant to say, if you have none of these risk factors, just low risk, no CT, they're good to go.
Yeah. Jim, can you briefly remind us about the PCARN intra-abdominal injury prediction rule? What is it?
Same thing that we did for the abdomen is what we did for the head. We modeled on intra-abdominal injury that underwent an acute intervention, basically specific interventions that you just don't want to miss. You don't want to send these patients home if they have these particular injuries. And we identified the variables that were important. That is, if you had one of these variables, you had some sort of risk. But if you had none of the variables, you were at such low risk, you didn't need a CT scan. And those variables were abdominal pain, vomiting after your injury, a GCS score of less than 14, absent or decreased breath sounds. If there's evidence of thoracic wall trauma, that is, you have erythema or abrasions to your chest wall, or if you had evidence of abdominal trauma, seatbelt sign, abrasions, ecchymosis to your abdominal wall, or you had abdominal tenderness. The absence of all those puts you at a very low risk. You don't need a CT scan. If you had one of those, doesn't mean you have to get a CT scan, but you're not at zero risk at that point.
Okay, before we move on, can you speak to the risk of getting that head CT or abdominal CT in a child? Remind us, why are these questions important?
Yeah, so I'll talk about the head CT. And, you know, there's several reasons why you do not want to unnecessarily get a CT scan. First, let me say that CT is great technology that we shouldn't be scared of. It's really changed the way we manage patients with trauma, both children and adults. However, the most important risk is the risk of radiation and radiation-induced malignancies. And there are a number of articles now that document the real risks of both lethal and non-lethal malignancies. In the past, you know, 15, 20 years ago, we had to extrapolate from the horrific events in Hiroshima and Nagasaki to the survivors to look at the risk of malignancies from the survivors. But now there are good data. So for head injury, the risk is a bit lower than from abdominal injury, which Jim can talk about. But for a typical 5-year-old who has one current generation CT scan, the risk of a lethal malignancy is about 1 in 5,000. And for every lethal malignancy, there might be a couple extra non-lethal malignancies. The younger you are, the higher your risk. So for a 1-year-old who has a head CT, the risk is about 1 in 1,000 of a lethal malignancy. And again, a few extra non-lethal malignancies associated with that. So for any individual who needs a CT scan, of course, you're going to get it. But from a population health point of view, there are likely hundreds of children per year who will unnecessarily die from one current generation helical CT scan. I mean, they don't die on the CT table. It's, you know, 15 or 20 years later, but it's a real important risk from a population point of view. But I'll pass it to Jim to talk about abdominal.
Yeah, the abdominal risk is a little bit higher than the head risk for a variety of reasons. The organs tend to be a little bit more sensitive than the head, but it's anywhere from 2 to 5 times the risk of a head CT. So you might be talking about, on a really young kid, someone that's less than 1 year of age, a risk of getting cancer of about 1 in 300 abdominal CTs that are performed. So very high risk. But if it's a adolescent male, the risk is much less, maybe 1 in 1,500 or so.
And I just want to add that, you know, people have asked us both, you know, why the difference in the age. And there's two factors. Is that one, of course, the younger you are, the longer time you have for that cancer to express itself. But also, the younger you are, you have more cellular turnover and more cellular metabolism that puts you at inherently greater risk as well.
Okay, so that's why. Tell us how you guys validated these prediction rules. Briefly, what were the methods that helped you understand this?
We did it together. We put both the head and the abdomen together. We got some grant funding from the NIH to do the study, and we put together a group of centers that were interested in validating the study, and we specifically chose sites that didn't participate in the derivation study. So these were non-PCARN sites participating. We had 5 others, so we had a total of 6 centers, and we enrolled over several years to get a total of 19,999 kids with blunt head trauma. We were once we finished, we were like, really? Oh. We couldn't enroll a couple more to get over 20,000, but, you know, still a very large sample of kids with blunt head trauma. And we ultimately enrolled 7,500 kids with blunt abdominal trauma. And we specifically asked the clinicians, is the patient positive or negative for the decision rule? And that's how we did the validation. And if they were positive, we asked the clinician which of the variables were positive. But we specifically validated the rule, as opposed to in the derivation studies where we were just collecting the data about each potential variable. Here, we validated the exact rule. We also collected inter-rater reliability about the rule to make sure that if I saw the patient and Julia, you saw the patient, we would agree if the patient was positive or negative in the rule. And we're happy to say that the rule had acceptable inter-rater reliability. That is, if you and I both evaluated the kid, we'd come to the same result. And so we spent a couple years enrolling all these patients. We had to slow down during COVID because there was no more pediatric trauma during a few months of COVID, but we ultimately were able to enroll these large sample sizes that showed that both of these rules worked very, very good.
And before we go on to talk about the results, I just want to add something to what Jim said, to what I had said before. So when we originally did the derivation and an internal validation of the head injury rule, remember I said that we just enrolled straight, so we didn't know what the variables were on the validation group when we did the validation because we hadn't created the rule. But as Jim's implying, what we did here, it takes a whole rule validation up to the next level of quality and preparedness for implementation, because here we no longer gathered all the variables. All that we gathered were the variables in the rule, because we just want, because this is what clinicians are going to do, and this is really the real world test, as opposed to the previous headroom, which was a statistical validation. This was, we just gathered the variables in the rule, and that's why it sort of took it up to the next level.
I feel like I very intimately know these methods because I'm pretty sure I enrolled at least 1,000 patients myself. And Jim, I'm pretty sure we did an inter-rater reliability form together because it did take a while to do all of this. And, you know, all of these trauma patients, it does feel like we see a large proportion of our trauma patients. And so it was definitely a large part of my practice for a while. So, Nate, we went through all of this. What did we learn?
So I'll talk about the head side, of course, and then I'll pass it over to Jim for the abdominal side. So the great news, because, of course, you know, we've spent, like, already at this point, let me just say, we've spent a decade of our lives, first of all, creating the rule. And in fact, some people ask both Jim and I, why did you guys do a validation of the head and abdomen? Because a lot of people have already validated the head rule. It's because research takes a long time. We got the grant to do this before anybody had validated the head injury rule. So then we got the money to do the validation of the head and abdomen. And meanwhile, others are starting to validate the head injury rule. So we sort of added like the cherry on top of the whipped cream of the validations, hoping that in fact we'd be able to validate. And what we found on the head injury side is that actually the rule was even more accurate than in our original derivation and validation, and was accurate and also very precise. On the children younger than two, the rule had 100% sensitivity. For older than two, it was 98.6. Both of those are higher than the original derivation with very narrow confidence intervals. And just the reason I would say for that is that now there's two things. It was a six-site validation. We probably had better quality control over six sites than the 20 or so that we did originally. And also now people were just focused on documenting the six variables in the head injury rule. And then Jim will talk about the abdominal rule. So the great news, validated almost perfectly. The two patients that we missed in the head injury were both older than two. Neither one of them required surgery. Neither one died. They both just required several days in the hospital.
That is absolutely amazing. So how does this new validation change your practice? Both Jim and Nate, how does this change things for you guys?
Well, I'll just mention, for the head part is that, first of all, of course, it provides a lot of confidence that we're using the rule correctly. And it's interesting to note that people were already incorporating the rule by the time they were doing the validation for the head injury study, because even though the population was essentially identical to the original population, because we know based on the rates of TBI, et cetera, were almost identical, the CT rates overall were already, were lower. And we also found for children who were at the lowest risk, that is with no predictors, CT rates went down substantially from the early prediction rule that we published in Lancet. So basically, this just reinforces and reassures us that we were doing the right thing. And the other nuance that was really important for me on the head injury rule is not only for the children with no risk factors, nobody had a neurosurgical injury, et cetera, but even for children with one PCARD risk factor, the CT rates were still pretty low. They were like 22, 23%. Meaning that there are a lot of children, as both Jim and I implied for these rules, that even if you have one factor, it doesn't mean you need a CT. Many of them just can be observed for a period of time. Once you started having two and more factors, of course, the CT rates went quite up.
Jim, what about you? How does this change your practice for kids that present with head injury?
Well, it doesn't change my practice for kids with head injury because I'm just doing the same thing, but I agree with Nate. It just tells you that it provides you with additional confidence. And we did provide a little bit more guidance with kids that were positive for the rule, kind of things that you could do for those patients. My practice doesn't change on the head because I was already using them in my practice.
Yeah, I would say the same thing for me as well. This is something that I've been using since, it was originally published. And so it doesn't change anything in my practice, but it has changed the way that I have the conversation with families. I've been, as more and more validation studies have come out in different countries, I don't know if you saw this morning, but there was one that was in Mexico.
For the head.
Yeah, for head injury. Yeah, that just was published this morning. It allows me to kind of have a rich discussion with families about the type of evidence that we're using to have these conversations and make these decisions. So I think that's really where I see the benefit in my own personal practice.
I was going to add one other thing, which it's not always true about prediction rules, but I feel it's true for both the head and the abdomen, is that particularly for the head, it also reinforces what is pretty clinically intuitive. That is, the patients at the highest risk in both age groups were the ones that had altered mental status and signs of skull fracture. And those are the two higher risk predictors in each of those rules. And then the other ones are lower risk that if they just have one of those, you can probably observe them without CT and they're fine. And that's kind of what made sense, but sometimes, it doesn't turn out that way and you really do need the evidence because we're talking about obviously a really important injury that we can't miss.
So, Jim, it was interesting to me that the number of children that presented with abdominal trauma were less than half of the number of children that presented with head trauma. Tell me what you learned from those children.
Well, you know, we validated the rule, obviously, and it didn't surprise us that much that our numbers were so much less within the abdominal cohort, because kids really getting significant abdominal trauma is much less than head injury. Kids hit their head all the time. I was working today, and they just kept coming in with head trauma, and there's no abdominal trauma in any of those. So that doesn't surprise me. But I will say, you know, this was the first prospective validation of the abdominal trauma rule, and I was using it as well, but, you know, you're a little thinner ground without a true validation. But I use that in my practice as well. And whenever I would go out and talk about abdominal trauma, I always say, this is just derived. It needs to be validated. We're working on it. And so, you know, this is it. It's validated. It validated better, similar to the head. It validated better than it did in the derivation study. And what I mean by that is the sensitivity was higher in the validation study than it was in the derivation study. We did not miss a patient with the intra-abdominal injury undergoing an acute intervention in the validation study. So it performed with a sensitivity of 100%, which really should reassure the clinicians that this is safe to use. And, you know, now it's time to implement these. I think people were already using the intra-abdominal injury rule when we were collecting this data, because if you look in the derivation study, patients that were negative for the rule, and we didn't know the rule then, but patients that were negative for the rule in the derivation study, 25% of those got CT scans. In the validation study, it was 12.6%, so basically half. And so I think people were already using the rule, or at least when they saw the paper form and they were like, this patient's negative for the rule, I shouldn't CT them. And so there's impact we see already with this rule. And that's definitely rewarding from a, you know, investigators, you know, standpoint, that you see your work that you're doing actually has impact and is improving care for injured kids.
Let me just add one thing on the head injury side. It's interesting that the numbers that Jim quotes on the head injury side as well, in the derivation studies, if you had no PCARN risk factors, the rate of CT was about 12 to 13%. And now in the validation study, about 5 to 6%. So just like Jim said, it cut it in half for that low risk group. And even for those with one factor or whatever, it also brought it down. So really interesting how the studies really did, in a way, mirror each other, although they're obviously different parts of the body with different implications.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. Jim, tell me a little bit about the specificity of it. How precise is this, or how specific is this tool?
There are plenty of patients that don't have the disease, don't have an intra-abdominal injury undergoing acute intervention, that still are positive for the rule. And we provide some guidance in the manuscript about those patients and things that you can do, right? Some of them just need to go to CT scan. You have abdominal tenderness and a seatbelt sign. Your risk is significant. You should just go to CT. There's no observation. You shouldn't be doing other things. They need a CT scan. But, you know, for someone that just has one variable, such as vomiting, that's a pretty low risk variable, that patient just probably needs some observation. You can get some laboratory screening for the abdomen. You could potentially do a FAST exam. So there are other options. With the head, it's primarily, if you have a variable or two and you're not sure you want a CT, it's mostly observation. We're not using lab tests to screen patients. But with the abdomen, when a patient's positive for the rule and haven't made the decision to get a CT, there are other things you can do while biding your time and observing that kid. Labs, FAST, and some time.
It's like gathering more data points, right?
Absolutely.
You know, those serial exams, the labs add to your suspicion. So it helps you kind of give that foundation, and then you can gather more puzzle pieces.
And then when the patient comes back with normal labs,
yeah,
and now they're running around the emergency department, you know, you feel better about discharging them home.
Yeah.
Right.
I want to give a plug to a very early study that Jim and I did actually. I think this is one that Jim started when he was a resident. I was a young faculty member, and, you know, Jim led this, and I was mentoring him on it. But it was a really great study, but a single center study for intra-abdominal injury. And we had found, you know, certain clinical factors that predicted, but we found three laboratory factors that were really important. And they were a low hematocrit, blood in the urine, or elevated liver function tests. And actually, when we were designing this, the PCARN abdominal injury study, we meant to study those labs as well, but once you enroll, there's 20 sites, people were not following the protocol exactly. So we were missing too many of those lab variables, so we weren't able to use it. But it's important for me because how I use the intra-abdominal injury rule, I use it the way we've done now, validated in PCARN, adds my confidence. But if they have, let's say, one of those intra-abdominal injury prediction variables, then I go back to our original study and I get these labs and I'm looking at for three things: a low hematocrit, blood in your urine, or elevated liver function test. So even though the PCARN study is more robust, multi-center, along the way you learn some important things that still can help.
Jim, how do you use the intra-abdominal injury prediction rule?
Like I said, I was using it before we validated.
Right.
Now I just feel better about using it. And so, and you'll see, because you've probably seen the emails, Julia, that we're fixing to implement kind of some guidelines for evaluating kids with abdominal trauma in our emergency department, which basically are based upon the validation study here. And so if the child is negative for the rule, I stop at that point from their abdomen. I'm not worried about their abdomen. They might need something else, a C-spine imaging or the head image. But from the abdomen, if they're negative for the rule, I'm done. If they're positive for the rule, then it depends upon what variable it is. And then I start talking about getting labs or the fast exam. And in this manuscript, we talk about a little bit when they have multiple positive findings on the abdominal rule. And we're going to have another manuscript that's going to come out in the future that talks about each of the individual variables and how important they are. But that's in the future, and I can't tell you now.
So if they're completely negative, then you're not even ordering labs, not a urine, nothing.
I'm not worried about their abdomen if they're negative for this rule.
I mean, that's huge, right? Yeah. In and of itself, not having to stick that kid and or wait for them to decide to pee in the emergency department. In this journey, let's look back globally, guys. What was the most surprising thing to you for deriving these prediction rules?
Let me start, because it's taken forever. Back when we started back in 1996, I was a resident, and I figured, oh, we'll do this in a couple of years, and we'll answer the question, and it'll be over. And even when I joined the faculty in 97, I was like, we'll just do a couple studies, we'll answer the question, and then, you know, I'll figure out a new line of research. But studying injured kids' abdomens has been constant for me since 1996. And Nate and I have an R01 clinical trial right now on abdominal ultrasound in kids. And, you know, we started on that back in the late 90s as well. And so, you know, this derivation and validation is taking 25 years or so. So I'm shocked at how long it took.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that Jim says that, because it reinforces to me something that my eyeballs always roll back when a junior investigator, resident fellow comes up to me and says, hey, Nate, I got this simple research project. I say, stop them right there. No such thing. No such thing as a simple research project. Part of being in PCARN, you learn this. If you want a study to be definitive, it's got to be big enough. So that means you need to get federal money, which takes time. And you know, everything takes time. It's every ride I've had in PCARN, it's 10 years. Head injury, like from start to the concept to publish that original paper, I'm not even talking about this validation, it's 10 years. DKA, it's 10 years. Everything, it takes a decade, because you know that first piece, which is a very challenging piece, is if you want it to be definitive, you need federal dollars to do it. And that adds a lot, as opposed to the early studies that Jim and I were doing. We were doing basically unfunded single center studies. So
that don't answer the question.
But they don't ultimately answer the question definitively enough to say, you're done.
Yeah.
Nail in the coffin.
Yeah. Nate, what surprised you in this journey?
You know, actually, I'll tell you that what surprised me, and this is just the, you know, revealing the skeletons in the closet, that, you know, multi-center research is great. It's very powerful. It's powerful for two main reasons. You get big numbers and you get diversity of patients, and that's very powerful. But what surprised me is that it's not all, you know, blooming flowers and birds chirping, you know, in doing multi-center research, and that, you know, and Jim and I have been on this this trauma trail for a long time together. We've had situations where one site, their data was really bad and we had to get rid of a bunch of patients. We've had situations just like I described where we thought they would be getting labs, they didn't get labs. So what I've learned is the trade-off. That is, sometimes you just have to do a multi-center study to answer the questions. But sometimes the single-center study might be better. If you don't need huge numbers, because you get really, really good quality control if you just do it at your own site, that you lose a bit of when you do a lot. So like life itself, there's always trade-offs, you know, and PCARM plays a really important role for these type of studies where you need really big numbers and, you know, you sacrifice other things. But for certain things, you don't need a PCARM and it's better just to do it at your own site.
Well, I'm glad that you guys kept pursuing this because I use both of these rules in my own clinical practice and I now feel fully validated in my own clinical practice. I personally access both of these rules inside of the EMR at my hospital, but you can also access them at MDCalc, which makes that decision with the family that much more evidence-based. And I document it in my own MDM all the time, and now I feel better about it. Is there anything else that you guys think that we should know before we go?
One thing that we'd like to add, both Nate and I, we would like to thank everybody that participated in this study because there were hundreds of faculty across these six centers that participated, enrolled patients at all times of the day and night. And even though the data form wasn't very long, it is still a hassle to fill it out. So Nate and I are very appreciative to everyone that helped with the study and filled out forms and collected data at their sites. We could not do it without your help.
Just to lay a little bit of magic dust of things to come ahead, as Jim already implied, there are still some unknowns, and you'll be hearing, I'm sure, at some point in the future from EM Pulse about this randomized trial of FAST in hemodynamically stable children with abdominal trauma that Jim and I are doing. We're in the middle of in another big PCARN study.
Can't wait for that. Thanks, guys. So that is it for this episode, guys. You can find more about these rules at PCARN.org and follow along at PCARN team as well on X and connect with us at EM Pulse at EM Pulse Podcast. See you next time.